Zoller, please go ahead.
Let me be the first to say good afternoon, Your Honors, as we continue this. And I'll be honest, I don't have a lot to add. I thought Mr. Kirsch's argument was very succinct and to the point, and my client basically joins in his argument as it was. But really, I just want to sort of reiterate that this case concerns a legal question about the interpretation of a statute of limitations. And this court has previously held that statutes, and in this case, even the exemption to the statute, are supposed to be read narrowly to protect defendants. And the lower courts in this case read this exemption very broadly, which is against that holding of, you know, limited exemptions to the statute. And that's really kind of all I wanted to reiterate and how this, what we believe this court should focus on. But if you have any questions, I'm happy to try and address anything else.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bunn.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. In creating the DNA tolling provision, the legislature could have easily said, for example, the time starts when the state possesses two things, the physical evidence and the actor's DNA sample, but it tellingly did not. And instead, it included very specific language, evidence necessary to establish the identification of the actor by means of comparison to the physical evidence. Our argument is that those are the words the legislature chose, and they mean what they say. Now, before the actual match is made between the suspect and the physical evidence, the state only had a possible investigative lead, unconfirmed by a sample taken directly from the newly identified suspect. And therefore, they were not in possession of the evidence necessary to establish the identification of the actor. Now, Mr. Kirsch stood here and repeatedly said they messed up, and it was their misunderstanding. But that is not true. At the time the sample was entered in 2002, when this particular science was still in its infancy, only 5 loci were entered. Per the lab's interpretation guidelines, 100 RFU was the peak height in a DNA profile that could be considered conclusive for match purposes. Anything below that was considered inconclusive and did not get reported on the DNA lab and was thus not included in the CODIS entry. In fact, back then, the analysts didn't even know that information could be included, and even if they could, they feared that they would be violating ENDIS policy. And I want to give some necessary context on ENDIS. In order to maintain its accreditation and access to CODIS, the lab is required to comply with all ENDIS policies and procedures, as well as all federal and state laws. These laws are very strict. They deal with quality and privacy requirements, and these requirements restrict intrusions on individuals. Now, the portion of the 2010 ENDIS manual that defendant is focusing on as an alternative argument is really important. I included it in my appendix at SA 12. It's also in the record. But this is the language of the actual ENDIS manual. It's section 4.2.1.1. It says, in accordance with the validation studies performed by and the standard operating procedures of the ENDIS participatory laboratory, any data used to make an exclusion can be included in the DNA record submitted to ENDIS. And that language has not changed even up to today. And what it means is that the exclusionary information, it can be added, but it's not required to be, and it's up to the lab and their standard operating procedures to do so. Now, the lab's chief concern then and now is the integrity of the lab. They are scientists, they are not prosecutors, they have no stake in the game, their processes and procedures are not dictated by the state police or any county prosecutor. In fact, the county prosecutor has no control over the state police lab. The lab is only concerned with processing data and reaching accurate conclusions. And the way they do that, my understanding is they take a conservative approach because of all these regulations that they have to follow in order to even maintain access to CODIS and its accreditation. They take a conservative approach with all of these things. If there's a question on whether something should be included or not, they're not going to include it because they have to. Very certain things either can or cannot be included in CODIS, and they're very careful with what they include and what they don't. There was no deliberate delay in testing here, and they certainly didn't just sit on their hands or choose not to test the samples. The state urges this court to find, as Judge Blue and the three-judge panel of the appellate division found below, that based on the plain meaning of the statute, time was told until the state obtained a match.
Are you done with your opening statement?
I am.
So you've repeated for us this afternoon what you had in your brief, that the clock doesn't start until you have the physical evidence and the match. Fair? That's the essence of your argument.
The essence, yes.
Can you have a match without the physical evidence? Not a trick question. I think the answer is of course not.
I don't know. I don't think you can. I think you need, in order to get the match, you need the physical evidence.
So let's take your reading of the statute and look at the words then. How could the legislature have meant what you're suggesting if you simply substitute match for the phrase about DNA? It would say the clock does not start until the state is in possession of both the physical evidence and the match. Does that make any sense?
So, I mean, the legislature certainly could have said that, but I think the reason that the legislature chose such specific words is to account for these, for the science and the fact that the science changes and our understanding might change.
But your reading of the plain language renders superfluous the reference to the physical evidence. That's not the right way to read a statute. Agreed?
That's not the right way to read the statute, but I don't agree that that's what our reading does. I think the whole statute needs to be read together and in relation to the statute of limitations, other parts of statute. And what it says is when it identifies the actor, and this court said in Twigs, identifies means to establish the identity of. So when it establishes the actor, we need the whole sentence, and it says by means of comparison to the physical evidence.
It says necessary to establish. It doesn't say actually established, right? You need both forms of evidence. The second, the DNA evidence, is needed to establish by means of comparison.
Yes. So, but if we were to look at defendant's interpretation of the plain meaning, he says, it just means two things, the sample and the physical evidence. But that's not what the legislature said either. And if we look at the legislative, the committee statements, the legislature specifically said, it referenced the backlogs and, it mentioned that the law has significantly increased the samples to be collected and that this is inundating the labs and causing significant backlogs. In those cases, the state would not be barred from prosecution. But in those cases, under defendant's interpretation, the state had both samples. So that alone renders defendant's interpretation wrong. And the other parts of the legislative history, they mention a suspect. Well, until we have the CODIS hit, there is no suspect.
Take a situation where you have evidence, you have physical evidence, a sample from the victim or from the crime scene, and the state has obtained a swab from the suspect. Clock's not running at this point, according to your calculation. Is that right?
That's our primary argument, that the evidence necessary to establish identification is the actual match. However,
could the state, under those circumstances, simply choose, let's assume for good faith reasons, they wanted to have more time to investigate a complicated matter. Could they choose not to send that material to the lab for a year or more and extend the statute of limitations by doing so?
If there was a valid reason for them to do it, if it was for investigative purposes, I don't see why they couldn't. But the other thing I want to note too is
the reason potentially might be you have a 5-year statute of limitations and you've just extended it to 7 years through your choice. Is that not a concern?
If the court is concerned with that situation, well then, under a reasonable interpretation of the statute, you could say that the clock starts when we obtain the buccal sample. And that would alleviate any possible concerns that we would just sit on our hands and let a known rapist and violent home invader remain on the loose because we can. And the other thing I wanted to mention, too, is putting aside the statute of limitations, defendants have plenty of protections. Even if there was some sort of delay in testing, some sort of deliberate delay to gain an advantage, and defendant was somehow prejudiced, then defendants still have a due process right. So even if the statute of limitations isn't violated, they could claim their due process rights are.
Didn't the state obtain a buccal sample in 2004 in this case?
The state obtained defendants' it was a buccal sample via mail from when he was on an unrelated matter. It wasn't entered till 2006 due to that processing.
Right. Error. No, I was following up on your earlier comment. The court could simply say it's when the buccal sample is obtained.
Oh.
Didn't that happen in 2004?
I didn't mean that one. I meant the confirmatory one once he became a suspect, because that's required not only by Endis but by the courts. So what I meant, our alternative argument is that the court could hold the statute runs at the time when we obtain the confirmatory buccal sample from the suspect.
Right, so I'm trying to understand your argument. So if there is a DNA sample from the crime scene and a DNA sample of the suspect, and there is a CODIS hit, and you know there's a CODIS hit, but for some reason, some lackadaisical technician decides not to transfer that information around for 6 years. You're saying it doesn't make a difference because we didn't get the confirmatory sample, correct?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because even the lab, and this requires that they have certain time frames. They have to make good faith efforts to get these things moving. So, and I believe there are certain
times. I'm talking for the purposes of the statute.
For the purposes of the
your interpretation of the statute is that it doesn't make a difference if there's a CODIS hit. Nothing starts running until we do a confirmatory sample. And if we don't get go for a confirmatory sample, then the statute doesn't begin to run, correct?
That is generally our argument. However, in that case, I mean,
I know you don't like the implications of it, but that's your argument.
But defendant could still argue that you know, it was an unreasonable delay, and he was.
I'm talking about your interpretation of the statute. I'm not moving on to whether or not they have a due process argument. I understand you're trying to say, oh, they may have some other argument to forestall some crazy application of the statute.
Okay, fair enough. Under our interpretation of the statute, evidence necessary to establish the identification is very specific. And when the lab sends out the hit notification, it's very specific. This is a possible investigative lead. No conclusion can be drawn of whether this profile actually matches the sample without the confirmatory buccal sample.
Are you saying, you heard your adversaries say that when there is a COVID, when there is a hit, okay, when you have the suspect's sample and you have the crime scene sample and you have an actual CODIS hit, and let's say 7, 8, 10 loci, he said that's sufficient for you to present the evidence before a grand jury, probable cause, hearsay, and get an indictment. Are you denying that?
I totally agree, and I appreciate that concession. And if the court were to find that reasonable, we certainly, I'm not going to die on the conclusion.
So it's good enough to get you're conceding it's good enough to get an indictment. Even without the confirmatory sample, the connection with CODIS is sufficient for you to present the case to the grand jury and get an indictment. Yes?
If he says it, I'm not going to agree. I don't think that's been briefed in this case, but I would certainly agree that would be probable cause at that point.
Well, if it is, then it's sufficient to get an indictment, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
But again.
But it's sufficient to get an indictment, but you're saying, but not sufficient to trigger the statute of limitations. Isn't that a little strange? You can get an indictment, but it won't trigger the statute of limitations.
So you just mean the CODIS hit?
Yeah.
That is a totally reasonable interpretation under the statute. If the court is inclined to agree with that, then I understand it. But our argument is the identity is not necessarily established at that point. We still need the confirmatory buccal swab.
Not for a conviction, perhaps, but enough to get an indictment going. Yes, right?
Okay.
And doesn't the statute talks about the commencement of the prosecution. That's getting an indictment.
Right.
So if the CODIS hit is sufficient to commence the prosecution, as it says in the statute, how does your argument that the confirmatory hit is what the legislature intended in this statute?
Well, our argument is the necessary to establish identification. I might have gotten confused with the hypotheticals. Our primary argument is that it is at the second sample. Once there is a...
Where does it say that in this statute? Where in the statute are you basing your argument that it was the legislature's intent that the second confirmatory sample is what should trigger the statute of limitations?
Our argument is that based on the extra language that they could have said DNA, the actor sample, they didn't. They said a lot of extra words that are very specific, and they say evidence necessary to establish the identification of the actor by means of comparison to the physical evidence. And that is our position, that it takes into account the changing science, that the science advances. So they could have easily said the actor sample, and they didn't. They said all of these extra words.
But this isn't a case where science had advanced to a point where suddenly the physical evidence and the DNA evidence were compared and then there was a hit. Isn't it correct that the sample that was taken at the crime scene was sufficient to match with the defendant's DNA?
They had the evidence taken from the crime scene and then they had defendant's DNA sample in 2006, but the science or their understanding of the science did not catch up at that time. And I need to make clear, at that time, the DNA science was in its infancy. The science changes, our understanding of it becomes very clear. And we might know in 20 years things that we don't know now. The science is always going to change. We're always going to have a better understanding of it. And the testimony was very clear.
So even in 2010, even if you make the argument that 2010 should be the triggering date, the statute of limitations has run by the time the indictment happens in this case, correct?
No, because the 2010 language is from the ENDIS procedures manual. Up until today, it still says the same thing. It is not required. It says up to the lab with their interpretation policies, it can be included. It was allowable. And now by the time that it was in, it's been in for a while, they understood, you know what, now we can include this information, we're going to include it. But they have to be very careful, because if they're not, if they include stuff that they're not allowed to or vice versa, they could lose their access to CODIS. So they have to take a conservative approach. If there is a question on whether something can or cannot be included, they are always going to err on the side of caution, which protects the defendants.
I want to come back to your read of the statute. Your primary argument, I thought, was that it meant the actual match itself.
It is.
And that the plain language clearly tells us that's what it means. And yet you're also arguing that the plain language tells us that it means confirmatory swab, which is very different, no?
It could be different, but, I mean, defendant has alternative arguments, too, based on the plain language, because the plain language, maybe it could be open to interpretation, but then we would just look at the legislative history.
And what does the legislative history tell us about confirmatory swabs?
It doesn't mention confirmatory swabs, but it does say evidence taken from the suspect. And evidence taken from the suspect, he has to be a suspect. And until they had the CODIS hit, he's not a suspect.
You took evidence from this suspect, or you can correct that term, in 2004, no?
He was not a suspect at that time. That was an unrelated...
That was just the JJC.
Yes, that was an unrelated matter, and he committed some other crime and was therefore eligible for that, and then it was uploaded few years later.
Why does the person have to be a suspect in order to establish their identification as the actor?
Well, the legislative history speaks of taking from a suspect, so that's why I said that. But based on the plain language of the statute, it says necessary to establish the identification. And both ENDIS and our courts require that the confirmatory buccal swab be taken, because up until then, it's just a possible investigative lead, and no conclusion can be made whether this person is matches the DNA profile.
You heard the question I asked your adversary. Do you know of a single instance where a match with CODIS was contradicted by a sample taken from the actual victim and DNA profiled?
I personally do not know of a case.
The reason why I ask that question is, can we assume that the stuff that's in CODIS is reliable? And I think the answer is yes.
That would be fair. I mean, we could certainly, and this is what it comes down to again, is the lab is very careful with, you know, what they include and what they don't, and they're always double checking, and they're always so making
When did the New Jersey scientists say, oh yeah, why don't we include this information? This is good. This is reliable. This is science. This makes sense. When did they make that decision?
So in this case, in 2002, they understood it as inconclusive, right, and they weren't entering it.
Started 2010.
2010, the relevant manual said this information can be included. And I'll point you to the record if you want the best explanation from what we have here. They said, well, there was a point where our analytical threshold and reporting threshold were one and the same. I'm not sure the exact date of that, but by the time that verbiage made it into the ENDIS procedure, it might not have been applicable to us, or maybe it didn't occur to us at that time that we could do it. Maybe we didn't need to. But with the data that we were looking at from our old kit, we had a lot of this exclusionary data. So during our audit, it occurred to us, because it was now written down in the ENDIS procedures, and we knew that it was allowable, that we could, because for profiles such as this, one where we weren't able to search it to generate investigative leads, now we could. So it was written down in 2010, and then sometimes it takes some time to understand, you know what, it's been written down, we can do this. But again, it's...
What's so difficult to understand? You can include this information. Do you have to be a scientist to figure that out? Okay, you can. Why would the federal authorities say you can't include it unless you should probably be including it?
Well, if it should have been included, then the ENDIS would have said it's required to, but it doesn't say it's required to. It says it can, in accordance with your own, the ENDIS participating laboratory's guidelines. It's up to the lab whether they want to include
it. Okay, so your position is, despite this 2010 treatise or manual from the federal authorities, that even today, if the state decided, yeah, they said you can do it, but we don't want to do it, then we wouldn't, you wouldn't be including that information. You're saying that you weren't required. Are you saying even today, if you didn't want to do it, you wouldn't have to input that information?
Honestly, that really gets into the science that I'm not prepared to get into. But the thing is the scientists and the members of the lab, they are very careful in what they include and whatnot. And it's really for the reliability of the results, for the integrity of the lab, and to make sure that they are following all quality standards, privacy requirements. It's very specific. And even the ENDIS manual, I included it in my entire appendix. It's almost 100 pages. It's very complicated. So they have to follow that in addition to all the federal rules, regulations, and state laws. So it's not as easy to say, oh, it says Ken, you should have did it. Well, that's not at all fair, and that's not the question we should be asking.
When did you first get a CODIS hit in this case?
The first CODIS hit was around April of 2016, and that was after the loci was entered.
And your contention is that's when the statute of limitations started to run.
Not exactly. Our position is that once they got the hit, because there was a couple weeks in between that where they have to confirm. They can't just issue hits.
Look, in 2016, I'm not asking April 1st, 2nd, 5th.
In
2016, you got a CODIS hit, and the statute of limitations started to run around then, and he was indicted in 2017, so your argument is we're within the statute of limitations, okay?
Yes.
All right, forget days. Let me just talk about eras, periods of time. You were not entering this particular sample from this crime scene in 2002, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You were not entering it in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
You were entering it. You could have entered it in 2010. You could have. I'm not saying you had to. I'm just saying you could have.
They could have.
All right. Now, sometime around 2010, as a result of the new NDI ENDIS rules, my understanding is there was an audit conducted.
Yes, in 2014.
Okay. So they get the ENDIS rules, and they begin to conduct an audit. At what point did you resubmit the 2002 sample?
So when the audit was initiated in 2014. That was for reasons unrelated to this. When
it was purely post-Endis changes.
Yes. So the
and you had a lot of backed up samples, and you were trying to supplement your findings based on the new Endis rules, correct?
Yes, so in 2014, when they came back to do it, they now knew more information.
I understand. That's not what I'm asking.
Okay.
So in 2014, you submit this 2002 sample.
By the time that particular sample was...
you started.
It was 2016.
Wrong
2016.
2014, you post-audit start entering these old samples that previously were of no use to you.
Yes.
And you get to this one in 2016.
Yes.
And by that time, you had this second buccal swab from, also had, I think, the second, you did not, okay, forget about the second.
That's why we got the second buccal swab.
So you get the hit, and you agree that somewhere around that time, the statute of limitations starts to run, correct?
Absolutely.
And your contention is, contrary to what your adversary says, that the key date is not when you had that 2004 second sample to match it to, it's when you had the information that would enable you to make the match.
Yes.
And that was in 2016.
Yes.
However, if we agree with defense counsel that the statute specifically says you're in possession of the evidence and you're in possession of the DNA sample, meaning the stuff from 2004, if we accept that, statute of limitations started to run in 2004, or at the latest, 2010.
Yes, if you were to accept
that. But if we accept what you say, and it's not that second stuff with DNA from 2004, but rather the DNA reading, that readout from the whatever that micro whatever analysis is, that tells you all the points of identification, until you have that, necessary to match to the 2002 evidence, the statute doesn't begin to run.
Yes.
Okay, so that's basically where the dispute is.
That's the dispute.
And your contention is that pertains, that's what you're talking about when you say CODIS match. You have information necessary to match the CODIS reading, the reading in CODIS,
right.
And that didn't occur until 2016.
Right, absolutely.
I got you. Okay, I'm just making sure because my head was starting to explode.
No, I appreciate it. It's very confusing and it's very scientific, and I don't want to get into the science, but that's what we're being asked to do, and that's what defendant is asking this court to do.
I understand. I'm just clarifying so my head didn't explode.
Just clarify. I thought you said earlier in response to Justice Solomon that the DNA sample from the crime scene wasn't entered in 2002. That's incorrect.
It was entered.
I just want to make sure that's clear. Yeah, exactly. I just want to make sure that's clear that it was entered, but it was entered in a manner that did not generate the hit when defendant's DNA was also entered into CODIS.
Yes, and I appreciate that clarification. It's because that certain exclusionary loci were considered inconclusive, and therefore they didn't include it. If it's considered inconclusive, they only want to include what was considered conclusive. And move on.
Because there was nothing, the two samples that were needed in order to generate this hit were in CODIS in 2004.
The two samples were in 2006.
In 2006.
Yes.
The two samples that were needed were both where they needed to be in 2006.
They were, yes, the physical samples were in CODIS.
Okay.
But again, I just want to point to just a brief part of the statutory history where the legislature accounts for the backlog and delay in processing, and in those situations where the legislature made clear the statute would not start tolling, the state would have possessed both physical samples, and that's why that interpretation is too narrow. I believe that's all, unless your honors have any other questions.
Your position, as I understand it, is if the state had in its possession the sample from the victim or the crime scene, and a sample from the suspect, who is identified as a suspect, the clock does not begin.
That's our alternative argument. Our main argument is that we have the evidence necessary to establish the identification once we have the conclusive match from the known suspect. But our alternative argument is that the clock could start running from the time you get the buccal sample, because then at that point you have the evidence from the suspect.
I thought you said it was the confirmatory buccal sample that starts the clock. So if the state has in its possession, and let's assume this is undisputed, the sample from the suspect and the sample from the crime scene, the clock's not running under your argument, under your reading of the statute. Is that correct?
Not under our primary argument, but that is our alternative.
Not under any of your arguments, as I understand it. Tell me what I'm getting wrong.
So our primary argument is that at the time after a code is hit, when the law enforcement agency is notified that you have a potential hit and that they need to go follow up, they get a buccal swab from a known offender, the suspect, they hand deliver it to the lab. When the lab is able to compare that and conclusively, you know, look at it and say this matches, that's our primary argument. Our alternative argument is that at the time that they know he's a suspect, they're told you have to go get a confirmatory buccal swab. That's the...
So the example that I've given you is not covered by either of those situations. An officer investigating the crime identifies someone as a suspect and gets a sample. That's not a confirmatory sample. This is early on. So they now have the sample from the crime scene and the sample from the suspect. Your position is the clock, for purposes of statutory limitations, has not yet begun. Is that correct?
Not in that situation until it's entered and compared.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything you'd like to add?
I think that's it. Thank you.
Mr. Kirsch.
Really quickly, Your Honors. Justice Solomon, you asked a question about that at one point, I think I heard a misstatement, and I just want to make sure I'm right. You mentioned...
By me or by defense?
Oh. From Your Honor. And I just want to make sure that we're clear, just on the facts. You talked about the time they got the peaks and valleys and all that. That was 2002. They did no new testing on that crime scene sample. And I just want to give you two sites from the transcript, from the motion transcript. Page 26, lines 2 to 24, and page 81, lines 1 to 9. The state, both scientists are crystal clear, we did nothing additional. We had everything we ever could have had.
I was not pointing to that.
Okay. Just making sure of that. The only other thing I will mention to you is if you... at all get into the legislative history here, there was some mention of backlogs being discussed in the legislative history. Be really careful. I didn't notice this when I wrote the brief, but I noticed it prepping the argument. Page 18 of the appellate division opinion has a block quote from the legislative history. Allegedly, it's the legislative history from the wrong statute. That's the one talking about backlogs. If you go through the legislative history that's on the legislature's site, the very first couple entries are from a statute that was not passed. It's a statute that actually completely eliminated the statute of limitations in all DNA cases. The statute, or the legislative history that I'm citing to you, comes
Senate
from...
Senate 1516?
I'm sorry?
Senate 1516.
Senate 1516. Senate 1516, the version that's adopted, if you look at the legislative history to that, the very first line of it says they mean getting the DNA sample as the triggering event once they have the physical evidence. And there is no mention in there about backlogs and all that stuff. That discussion entirely came from the version of the statute that was ultimately rejected. It's a minor point, but I just want to make sure that that citation in the appellate division opinion doesn't hold any water here, because it wasn't adopted.
Mr. Kirsch, was any finding by the court that the science as of 2010 and based upon the federal manual required the state to be putting in the other loci?
Required? No, not required. The 2010 manual made clear what NDIS thought everyone understood before that. The testimony is really clear that the understanding of the scientists back from 2002 until 2010 was based entirely on anecdotal understanding. It was coming from the top, but it was all unwritten. I can give you a couple of sites on that. Page 64, line 21 to 22, This is scientist Samuel. I don't believe there was anything that was written down. Page 68, lines 11 to 15. I don't think our CODIS manual was very detailed regarding that sort of thing. This is just what came down from the CODIS administrator at the time. That's just how we did things.
You heard your adversary basically suggesting that it was like optional for the states whether or not to include the, exclusionary loci.
It's optional if they want to miss the statute of limitations, but they have, at that point, they possess the two things that the statute says you need to possess. The clock's running. Now, in 2010, the manual makes clear what was understood all along. They still waited until 2014 to even audit their system.
You heard adversary quote the can provision, and she's saying that doesn't say we're required to, then we have to use our own judgment, scientific judgment, whether or not it should be included.
But what changed? Why did they audit themselves in 2014? They audited themselves because this manual changed. Then it took them two more years to enter the sample. In other words, there wasn't some great revelation that the science hadn't changed or any of that. They just didn't know all the way back in 2002 that they could have been entering this stuff. They got a clear message in 2010 that they could enter it. They still didn't enter. Still waited more than 5 years.
Is your argument that the science opening that you acknowledge is available in this language relates more to methods that improve the ability to extract DNA or fingerprint
detect
from an item that the police, that law enforcement may already have but didn't know before, that they could get a sample that would be capable of providing DNA or fingerprint evidence?
Right, because the way I'm trying to read the statute in a reasonable way to accomplish a legislative goal, which is when you're talking about possessing the physical evidence and the DNA sample, you're talking about what can be used to make a match.
Well, my point of my question is that your argument, I think, would apply equally to fingerprint evidence because it's used in the same part of the sentence. So as methods of extracting fingerprint evidence improve, it's not then the match or time later. It's the ability to extract it that you're acknowledging allows for the growth in scientific knowledge and ability.
Right, because it's when you have the ability to extract that evidence that you become in possession of that evidence, not necessarily. Like, if you just have the sock, the mask, whatever, and you can't get any DNA out of it, the clock doesn't start running then. The first part of that is the ability to actually get it, and that's where the advances in technology come along.
Can I just clarify one thing?
Mm-hmm.
When you talk, you said pretty specifically, I think, when you have the evidence related to the crime and the evidence containing the DNA match, that's when the statute starts to run. Correct? The evidence, you know, you've got the cap, the ski cap, but you extract the sweat, or it's the sweat or the fiber or whatever, when the state has that, and they have the original, whatever the stuff is from which they get a DNA readout from the original crime, statute starts to run.
Well, it's when I think you just said two of the same thing. They have the item from the crime scene.
Yes, you're right, they did.
That they're now.
The buccal swab was the second one.
They have
the stuff from the hat.
Right.
From which they can do a DNA readout.
Yeah, the stuff on the hat.
Get the buccal swab.
Right.
When they have those two things, statute starts to run.
Yes.
The state seems to be contending that when they've got the readout from the crime scene, which they can use to match a subsequent buccal swab, and they have the readout from the subsequent buccal swab.
From the second one.
From any one of them. They have both. And they make the match, that's when the statute starts to run.
Right. Their primary argument is that the second thing is the match rather than...
Or it could be the first thing if there's enough in the DNA analysis to match the other thing they already have. In other words, they had the first buccal swab and they had the DNA readout that contained the 7 points. The statute would start to run. But until they had the 7 points, they couldn't do the match.
Well, no, they could. That's
not... No, I understand you're saying that, but they're saying the statute doesn't run at that point.
Well, but even if you were to accept that...
I'm not asking you to argue with them. I'm just saying that seems...
Even if you were to accept that argument from them, 2010 would be when that started to run.
Because then they could submit it and get the...
Right.
But just understand what I'm saying. Until they did that, the contention is, and they sent those 7 points to compare, they don't have the evidence to make the match and the evidence to match it up with. That's what their contention seems.
That's what their contention is. Where they're wrong in this particular case, is because their understanding of why they didn't submit all the evidence rather than just the 5 was wrong.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand that.
I don't have anything else.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement.